science enthusiasts. I'm your host, Jason Zukowski. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, but you probably know our dogs, Bunsen and Beaker. They're the science dogs on social media. This show takes what's best from their account, the curiosity and fun found there, and swirls it into podcast form. Every week, we're going to take some deep dive into an area of science and look at the research that's going on with our pets. We'll also have an expert guest who will enthrall you with their area of knowledge. This is the Science Podcast. Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us again for another week. We hope you're happy and healthy out there. I think Chris is pretty much done with our winter. It's in the span of since the last podcast episode, it has snowed, warmed up and been gorgeous. And it has it's just finished snowing for another 24 hours. The dogs love it. They were out to this morning with me frolicking in the wet, fluffy snow. But for most people in Alberta, they just can't wait for that nice weather to kick in and keep the snow away. On the Science Podcast this week, in science news, we're going to take a look at the new, quote-unquote, new and broken physics swirling around on social media and talk about the muon and just give you some backstory on that in a way that hopefully makes sense to you and makes sense to me because it's pretty complicated. In pet science, we're going to look at a new study that came out about therapy dogs and kids in school. Our expert guest this week is Michael Norton, who works in forestry in Alberta and the science that goes into all of the things that revolves around trees in Western Canada. And for those of you who don't live in Western Canada or Alberta, it's going to be a really interesting discussion. And I found it interesting. I learned so many things from him about our forests, about trees. Hey dogs, what's a tree's favorite dating program? Timber. I got another one. There's so many good tree ones. Why did the tree need to take a nap? Forest. Forest. Okay, on with the show. There's no time like science time. This week in science news, a little bit of physics. So that's exciting. Have you been hearing on social media about broken physics, new particles, new exciting studies in physics, the muon, and you've been like, I don't get it? If you were like that, you were like me. I didn't take much high-level physics, so anything outside of chemistry physics, like proton, neutron, electron, and, you know, radioactive decay, it kind of goes in one ear and out the other. So I thought I would parse out what's going on with this G2 muon thing. All right, so our story begins back in 1998, where a massive group of researchers looked at the muon's magnetic field, and in this study back in 1998, found that the muon's magnetic field deviated from the standard model. A current team of international researchers on April 7th confirmed the original study's findings. Okay, so that's the conclusion. Now, what does it even mean? Why is this possibly a big deal? What the heck is a muon? What is the standard model? If you had these questions, you're not alone. All right, a muon is like an electron, but it's 200 times bigger. It's a chunky electron. Think like a mouse compared to Bunsen. But both electrons and muons are really tiny, 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 tiny. So it doesn't matter really that a muon is that much bigger. Well, it does because it's way bigger. But compared to things in real life, they are infinitesimally small. It's like comparing Bunsen to basically an entire planet, or even bigger, a Bunsen to a solar system. So we're talking about little teeny tiny particles. Muons are really unstable. So that's why we don't really talk about them that much, because muons decay in millionths of a second. It's really hard to wrap your head around. They're like here today, gone tomorrow. No, they're like, I can't. They're like, they're here now. Like they're just, they go so quickly in and out of existence. They also are really hard to detect. You have to look for them in a vacuum. And unlike what I thought a vacuum was, because remember, I didn't take a lot of high level physics. A vacuum is a really complicated place when you get down to things that are really, really small, like the quantum mechanical level. This is kind of beyond my pay scale, but in a vacuum, there are all of these virtual particles popping in and out of existence all the time. And one of these virtual particles may be affecting the muon's strength of magnetism. Okay, wait. Just a second. Didn't I just say the study was done in 1998? Yep. It took the researchers 20 years to measure the absolute strength of a muon's magnetic field. And it was incredibly complicated. Like, I was reading what they did, and it didn't really make sense to me. They had to have, like, a magnetic ring, and they shot, like, stuff at it at the speed of light, and then there was detectors, and things kind of went blah, blah, blah. And muons are really heavy, but they're negative, so instead of through all of this data, after a lot of number crunching, they got 3.5 standard deviations from what the standard model says. Basically, they got something that normal physics doesn't predict. Now, if you're wondering what the standard model is, don't feel bad. Most people don't even know what that is. The standard model is like all of the subatomic particles that you've probably heard of, and ones you haven't. Like, you've probably heard of a proton, a neutron, an electron, but there's little teeny tiny ones that do weird stuff in the standard model, like leptons and quarks and neutrinos. And really lately, you've probably heard of the Higgs boson that was found by CERN. So anyways, this data didn't jive. It was an older study that took a while to do, but it was a carefully constructed experiment. Now, this ring thing that they built, okay, the scientists built, it was sent to Fermi Labs in Illinois and basically was crazy beefed up. It was beefed up with better technology, so more muons could be experimented with. And it was that same experiment was run a bunch more times. Now, this experiment is called the G2 experiment, the muon G2, with G meaning the strength of the magnetic field spin. I went into the study to figure out, like, they beefed it up. What did they do to measure muons? It's also really technical. They built calorimeters, and for me in chemistry, a calorimeter measures heat, but they built these calorimeters made out of lead fluoride crystals. And they use these things called photomultipliers and Cherenkov radiation, which is basically blue light. Breaking it down, all of this nerdy stuff measures the wobble of a muon, like a top. And how a muon wobbles is predicted to be this crazy accurate number. So this team took that old experiment, souped it up a bit, like they made it better, they mega-sized it, and they got so much data, it took them years to go through it. And so much data, they set up 6 independent international teams, all working independently from each other. They weren't allowed to talk, so they could see what the data came to at the end. So these 6 groups were working, and literally in April, they released their findings. And the cool thing is that when all of the groups came together, all of their data was consistent. And the consistent consensus was that the original experiment was correct. The predicted wobble of the muon didn't occur. The lead scientist of this team, Lawrence Gibbons, stated that while the data that they're basically giving out to the public or to other scientists to look at is only 6% of the data they collected, it indicates something new is going on. Something that they don't predict, something is happening to that muon. And what is it? Well, the answer is they don't know. So if you're asking, like, why is this a big deal? The answer is that it's a big deal because it's something in physics that doesn't follow what was predicted. And what could that potentially be down the line? That's a really hard question to answer. And it always brings me back to this really profound thing that a former guest said on the show, Sophia Gadnasser. She's the dark matter astrophysicist. And she put it to me this way. When I asked, like, why do we care about dark matter? Like, what's going to happen if we figure it out? And she's like, the answer is we don't know. That's like asking scientists to explain what we would do with the radio waves if we could control them. And back then, they had no way of understanding how light was also radio waves because they didn't know radio waves existed. So that was like asking a scientist, you know, if we could manipulate light, what would you do? Well, they wouldn't have any idea about all of the technologies that would come of it. If you hear the G2 experiment, that's it. It's deviated from what was expected. It deals with muons, which are chunky electrons, and it's not something that was predicted. That's science news for this week. This week in Pet Science, we're going to talk about a UBC Okanagan study that looks at how children react with therapy dogs. I think we can all agree if we are dog lovers ourselves, there's an assumption that if you're working with a dog through an intervention, it's going to be effective because people are going to love dogs too. There hasn't been a lot of data about that. Like, therapy dogs, yes, are useful. Therapy dogs, the data shows they are very, very helpful with dealing with trauma, with bringing kids down who are having their emotion pinned and need to be centered. There hasn't been data gathered, like, do the participants like working with the dog? Like, it helps, but do they like it? The lead author of the study is Nicole Harris. She's a master's student at the School of Education at UBC Okanagan. Her study looked at how kids react with participating in a social skills training program with therapy dogs. So what did they do? Well, they took 22 kids from a Boys and Girls Club who take part in sessions to help them build their social skills. And over the course of about a month and a half, the children were accompanied by therapy dogs from Bark. That's building academic retention through canines. That's adorable, Bark. And they completed all these different social lessons. Now, each week, the kids were taught a new skill, such as, you know, introducing themselves to others, something that's kind of like, you know, scary from a public speaking standpoint, or giving people directions or explaining a task. The kids would first practice with a therapy dog and then practice their new skill with everybody else. In the final phase, the kids were accompanied by their friend as a moral support, then would practice their skills with adults in the building. So it went from something where they were just practicing with a dog, practicing with their peer, without their dog, and then having the dog with them to practice their skills with somebody that's not of their peer group. Now, the evidence from the study seemed to show that the social skills of kids when paired were way better when paired with the therapy dog. The dogs created a very non-threatening environment in which the kids could learn new skills. The kids practiced and honed their skills alongside the dog. The observation suggested that the canine assistant social and emotional learning initiatives provide huge advantages. One saw that interacting with the therapy dogs, the kids' moods improved and their engagement with the lesson increased. Of course, they tested it versus like a human giving the same lesson, and they found that the kids were way more engaged with the therapy dog than a person. 87% of the team rated the kids' engagement level as very or extremely engaged during the sessions. Man, if I could have 87% engagement every day with my kids in school, that would be a big win. At the end of the 6 weeks, month and a half, the team interviewed some of the kids, eight of the kids who came regularly. So they would, they're the ones that had the most experience. And they found that all of the kids enjoyed it. It was a positive experience. And the dogs were a very meaningful part of the program. A couple of the researchers said the kids seemed to behave better when there were dogs than in other places without dogs. At least half the kids mentioned that the dogs helped with their emotional well-being, and one of the kids credited the dog with helping him become more responsible and control his silliness. It keeps the kids more centered. Harris says that dogs have the ability to provide many stress-reducing and confidence-boosting benefits to kids, and it's really heartwarming to see the impact the program had on the kids. So, this is a very short study, but it gives more data and more evidence for schools that are taking unique approaches to improve the emotional and the social skills of kids at young grades. That's one of the things that we as a society need to think of, like improving the social and emotional well-being of our students. That's a huge part of mental health. Mental health doesn't just start when you're an adult. Mental health travels with you from the time you're born until the time you leave the earth. And having dogs be part of that journey could be something that increases those kids' chances of improving their social and emotional well-being. That's Pet Science for this week. Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Science Podcast this week. The Science Podcast is always going to be free to download, but if you want to support the show, there's a couple things you can do. The first one is sign up on our Patreon page, patreon.com/BunsenBurner. There's multiple tiers of support. We have a ton of fun with the patron group. You get to be on the podcast. You get postcards from Bunsen and Beaker. You get swag. You get early pictures. You get a whole bunch of awesome stuff. So check it out. The lowest tier is only $5 a month.
The other way you could support the show is checking out our merch shop. Our merch shop is hilarious. It's got all of these adorable cartoons of Bunsen and Beaker. We keep producing more. I just want to thank the people that have supported the show that way. We're really, really proud of our merch shop because the merch, the clothes, is really high quality. The colors are vibrant, and we come up with some really fun designs all the time. So check it out. That's at BunsenBurnerBMD.com. Thanks, everybody. On to the interview.
It's time for Ask an Expert on the Science Podcast, and I have Michael Norton, who is the Director General of the Northern Forestry Center in Alberta. How are you doing today, Mike?
I am doing fantastic. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, great. Yeah, I'm super excited to talk to you. You are in Alberta. Are you an Albertan born and bred, or did you move here?
I am one of many that moved here. I grew up in Ontario, but I'm proud to say now I have lived in Alberta longer than I ever lived in Ontario. But I did grow up in the Ottawa Valley in Ontario and moved out here in 1994, thinking I was only going to stay for 2 years or so, and never left.
Did you get bit by the Alberta bug? All of the things here.
I got bit by a whole bunch of things. I mean, you know, professionally, the place worked out great for me, but I also met and married a native Albertan who has family in the area as well. So.
Oh, there you go. That's a good reason to stick around. where's home for you in Alberta?
I'm in the city of Edmonton.
Nice. Okay. So you're just north of us in Red Deer.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. The capital of Alberta for the people not from Canada, if you're keeping notes. The other question we've been asking our guests, how are you and your family doing with coronavirus, Mike?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I would say we are doing as well as anybody could be expected to do. You know, I'm fortunate to have a line of work that has been secure, so I don't have to worry about the paycheck. We've all stayed healthy. The kids are happy to be back in school right now. So, you know, after things like that, pretty much everything else pales by comparison. I feel it's not, although we do have days where we would love to see family and friends, you know, in the grand scheme of things, we're doing okay. I hope the same's for you.
Yeah, it's about the same. My wife and I are both teachers. So once things were relatively safe to have kids back in the classroom, that was a big, big game changer for me as a teacher, was those face-to-face interactions with kids. Even if I only get to see their eyes, because we are 100% masked up school. So
yeah, for sure. Mad respect for all of you teachers and the work that you've had to do the last year. Tough.
It was tough online, I'll tell you that. Yeah, but you know what? Everybody's had a rough go in different parts of their jobs too. Are you pretty sick with Zoom calls? Do you guys do Zoom or Google Meet calls?
Yeah, Microsoft Teams is dominating Microsoft my workplace. Teams. Yeah, still doing some Zoom as well. And yeah, the novelty of that wore off a long time ago.
I'm all done. Yeah,
although there are some aspects of this that I hope actually do stay with us once we can at least partially return to the workplace there. You know, we work across the country as part of the federal government, and the ability to see people through the video screen rather than just on the phone all the time actually has some real advantages that while I look forward to not working in my basement all the time, the comfort that everybody's developed with the video conferencing technology actually, I think will have some lasting benefit for us.
This is true. I was talking to my older son about some of this too. And I think a lot of families, once everything is back to quote unquote a newish or more normal, like for example, like skip the dishes. I think a lot of people have enjoyed having like a family meal come to them if you live in a city and they may not be going out to restaurants as often. I still hope we support restaurants big time because, you know, those people are part of our community. But I don't know. That's what we've been doing as a family. I've been going into town and getting some food, and that's something I've really enjoyed. It's actually been kind of cool. So
yeah, same here. I miss eating out, like really out, but we order in from a locally owned restaurant at least once a week, to partly for the variety and to take a night off from cooking, but also to try to do what we can to support the local and independent businesses to get
nice. I've heard a lot of Canadians are doing that. That's great. Okay, well, let's switch gears and let's talk about you, because that you're our guest. Could you tell everybody a little bit about what your training and education is and where you are in your career right now? I did mention you have this kind of impressive sounding title, the Director General. How did we get there?
Oh, it was a bit of a circuitous path. Certainly no particularly grand design at the time, although looking back, things have worked out really remarkably well for me. So I did grow up in Ontario. I did a first degree at the University of Guelph in biology and ecology. It wasn't a very specialized degree. I sort of followed my interests mostly in the space of natural resources and wildlife ecology and things like that. From there, and what originally brought me to Edmonton was I decided that I wanted to continue with the post-secondary education and try grad school. Cast around and ended up selecting a professor at the time at the University of Alberta and came out to Edmonton, never having been to Edmonton really before other than just a pass through, and therefore figuring I was coming for just a couple of years to do a Master of Science degree at the U of A in the biology department there in forestry and wildlife applied research. I had a scholarship that was sponsored by Alberta Pacific Forest Industries that I'm eternally grateful for, and decided that the master's was enough. I had lots of friends who went on to the PhD. I decided that was not for me at the time, hit the workforce. Very fortunate to get a first kind of real career type job with a not-for-profit organization called the Alberta Conservation Association, working roughly on endangered species conservation. And then landed a first job within the federal government and the Ministry of Environment as a wildlife technician, which I just thought was the absolute dream job. And I spent a few years driving all over, mostly Prairie Canada, surveying and monitoring songbirds and shorebirds.
Wow.
Saw some absolutely remarkable parts of the prairie provinces. Doing that,
provinces, yeah. Plural. Like, did you go into Saskatchewan?
Yeah, Alberta and Saskatchewan. I didn't personally do any work in Manitoba, but all over southern Alberta, southern Saskatchewan.
And when you get into Saskatchewan on those prairies, like, you probably saw some incredible sunrises and sunsets.
Here. Oh, absolutely amazing. I mean, I'm not a super early morning person, but when you're doing bird work, you have to be up at that time of day. I'll tell you, the most unbelievable landscape to this day anywhere that I've ever seen is actually at Canadian Forces Base Suffield in southeastern Alberta. And of course, as a military base, it's highly secured, and only certain people with all the right permissions can get in there. But it's a remarkable patch of almost entirely native condition natural prairie. And the eastern strip of that base is set aside as a national wildlife area that the military uses as sort of a buffer area, but they don't actively work in there. And I spent a couple of summers in there working on the bird communities of that patch of grassland. And it's just remarkable, absolutely remarkable part of the province, part of the country.
Yeah, very cool. So from the technician, you moved where from that?
Yeah, so I moved around. Environment Canada was very good for me. It's a big department with a very broad mandate. And once I was inside the federal government, my eyes started to be open to jobs and lines of work that I frankly didn't know existed until I arrived there. And so after a number of years in the Canadian Wildlife Service, I started to get exposed to other things that the department was doing. Moved from there into the Environmental Assessment Program, and worked for a while as a supervisor and manager in that program. The job of which was to provide specialist and technical commentary on environmental impact assessment reports related primarily at the time to oil sand developments, and took part in the regulatory review processes before various permits and things were issued for some of those large projects. And again, that started to broaden my horizons. Also gave me the first taste of managing, which I surprised myself by discovering that I actually quite liked. And so from there, a director's position opened up, and I took a run at that. So a little over 10 years ago, I moved into executive management with the federal government with the environment department. And then from there, I became the regional director general at Environment Canada here in Edmonton, a big region for the Three Prairie Provinces, Northwest Territories, and Nunavut. And again, you know, whole other new areas of field. One of the things I've loved about working for the federal government is there's just always something new and rewarding to do. And so in that role, I was quite involved in transboundary waters issues, which is a remarkably complicated space, but super important, especially in a water scarce part of the country like the prairies. So I was fortunate to serve as the chair of the Prairie Provinces Water Board, and I also chaired the Mackenzie River Basin Board, which were these structures to bring mostly governments together to avoid proactively disputes where related to water quantity and quality as rivers cross borders. Very neat work. And then coming sort of almost full circle back to the forestry space, the position at the Northern Forestry Center opened up, and I had at that point not done anything in the forestry space for quite a number of years, and mentally had sort of thought I'd moved on. But when the position opened up at the Northern Forestry Center again, I put my name in the ring and was successful. And I've been with the Northern Forestry Center for it's about 6.5 years now. It's amazing how time flies.
Awesome, a very varied career. So right now you're with the Northern Forestry Center. For people that are listening who have maybe never been to Alberta or Canada, what can you tell us about why that forestry center exists? Like why do we need that? What's its importance?
Yeah, I almost need to start by just talking a little bit about the importance of our forests in the first place, from which and why we have these forestry centers across the country kind of falls out from there. So. Certainly for Canadians listening, this won't be any particular surprise. We are a very forested country. We have roughly 350 million hectares of forests in this country, which amount to over 9% of the total global forest cover.
Really, almost 10% of the world. Hey?
Almost 10% of all forests in the world are found in Canada. There's only two countries that have more forest than we do. Those are Russia. Maybe no surprise there. It's a huge country.
Can I guess the next one? Brazil?
You are correct.
Yes.
Gold star. Yeah. I mean, obviously, there's a strong correlation to, you know, big countries that can, you know, have large areas Brazil's of things, big. But Russia, Brazil, Canada, USA, and China are the top five in terms of forest area in the country. So almost 40% of Canada is covered in forests. We divide that up into, you know, recognize sort of roughly 8 forest regions in the country. The smallest one is called Carolinian forest, which is actually not that unusual of a forest type. There's lots of it in the United States, but it only just barely creeps into Canada in far southern Ontario. The boreal forest, though, is the big player. So 78% of forests in Canada are in the boreal zone, and this is a forest that in Canada stretches from Newfoundland and Labrador in the east all the way to Yukon in the West. It's a, it is in fact a global forest region, runs all the way through through Siberia and right around the globe. That way, so we have a lot of forest, and the forest is tremendously important, and you know, could go on at great length for all the ways that it's important. But I'll just use maybe a couple of examples that I think may resonate with folks about why our forests are important to us. Two-thirds of Canadian drinking water comes from surface waters, rivers and lakes, and almost all of that is sourced from forested watersheds. So the you know, what comes out of most of our taps is dependent on forested watersheds for the production of you know, the right volumes and quality of water that that we drink. And although I don't have a number at hand, the other thing that is increasingly recognized as important is related to carbon. There's a huge amount of carbon stored in our forests. At times, there's a huge amount of carbon that is emitted by our forests as well when fires happen, for example.
Right,
but
yeah.
but the whole issue of carbon management when we speak about climate changes is super important. And if I bring it down to Alberta, the area of forest in the province of Alberta is larger than the country of Sweden. So we're still, even at the provincial level, we're still talking about huge areas of forest. To put a different spin on the importance of forests as well, and sort of the estimate in the province of Alberta is that somewhere around 40,000 total jobs are supported by our forest sector. So it's a tremendously important wow. part of our economy, particularly to smaller communities that are in forests. You know, you think about where people see sawmills and pulp mills and so on. They tend to be in smaller communities for which the forest sector is important part of their local economy. I think the recent figure is something around $8 billion in revenue, again, at the level of the province of Alberta. So it's a super important part of the economy. So to come back to your question about forest centers, we have a huge amount of forest that is tremendously important from an environmental standpoint and is tremendously important from an economic standpoint. And so the role of the Northern Forestry Center, which is just one of five of these centers across the country, you know, our job is about doing the research, scientific research, to generate the information base that we need to responsibly manage our forests and to ensure that we have a sustainable and vibrant forest industry.
Very cool. Very cool. It's like the brain of the industry, hey?
More of a network. Yeah, a node in a network. There's lots of other players in the space as well. Right. But for sure, so my center, I should also contextualize, my center is part of a national organization called the Canadian Forest Service. Okay. And so we have centers in research centers in Victoria, British Columbia, and other places further east as well. As I said, there's five. We are all told, we are the national center of expertise, the national voice, if you like, for forests and the forest sector in the country.
Okay, cool. What a great contextualization of what's going on with forests. I love it. So one of my follow-up questions to that is like, okay, forests are critical for the two main things: watershed water, right? That you mentioned, and carbon sequestration, like our carbon dioxide, climate change. Is there an issue that you feel that is coming up for forests in general, or forests in Alberta that that you could tell our listeners about?
Yeah, for sure. In fact, if you don't mind the sort of slightly flippant start to this, I'm going to talk. I would talk about three issues, and those three issues are climate change. And you'll see what I mean by that. So our climate is changing. We know that. We know why it's changing from anthropogenic emissions of greenhouse gases. We like to say that there is no solution to climate change without forests, from at least a couple of perspectives. Hmm. The one that I can may come as a bit of a surprise to some, I think, is in renewable energy. And when people think about renewable energy, the most common ones come to mind are things like wind and solar. But there are other sources of renewable energy that are being developed from an R&D perspective quite actively right now. And one of those is in biomass, which can have forestry linkages. It can also have agricultural linkages in important ways as well. The theory here is that, you know, if we can take carbon that has been sequestered into biomass, whether, you know, trees in this case, and if the forests are being sustainably managed, which is a crucial precondition for the viability of biomass energy, we are working in a couple of spaces here. One is that there's a lot of what we call residue, essentially waste product, left behind after commercial forest harvesting. And there are opportunities to sort of understand what that waste stream looks like and to find ways of capturing it to get a higher value use out of it. One of the relatively simple ways is to capture and process that waste into pellets that can then be used for heating, for example, which has major implications in northern communities that are often dependent on non-renewable energy, including kind of the worst form of that is imported diesel fuel to burn for heat and so on. So, you know, characterizing these biomass supplies to be able to then produce pellets that become an economic opportunity for the companies that produce them, and use those then to displace less sustainable forms of energy is one way in which we can harness that material. The other one that's really perhaps a little earlier in the development stream, but as of I think about 2019, did achieve kind of a commercial proof of concept, and that is the conversion of some of that biomass into renewable natural gas. ATCO in Alberta achieved, I think it was about 2 years ago, achieved the first injection of renewable natural gas that had been produced from forestry residues into its regular natural gas network. So that's not yet implemented around here on a commercial scale, but has tremendous potential to start to provide a more sustainable dimension to some of our energy systems. So that whole biomass space is one area that we and many other players are working quite hard on.
Okay, I get it. Okay, so can all right, so, okay. Commercial forest is quote-unquote farmed, cut down to make paper, stuff for houses, all of that, right? And there's things that were left behind that would just be left behind to rot and thus give their carbon dioxide back to the environment anyways. So these biomass technologies are taking that residue that would just be giving back their carbon dioxide anyways and turning it into something that humans would use and thus displace other worst greenhouse gas emitting or pollution causing things. Am I on the right track?
You are absolutely on the right track there.
That is fascinating.
The other dimensions that fit around that, of course, is that the harvesting of the trees, in many cases, especially in Alberta, will produce durable products like lumber that go into construction. And so the carbon that is part of that lumber then stays sequestered in the lumber. But as I mentioned, sort of the one of the absolutely crucial conditions that has to be in place is that the forest itself has to be managed in a sustainable way. So of course, once the harvesting is conducted, those harvested areas have to regenerate. In some cases, that involves tree planting. In other cases, quite appropriately, it's a natural form of regeneration. But how much we're harvesting, and how we're harvesting it, and how we're regenerating the harvested areas all becomes a crucial part of the equation that leads to a conclusion that of the sustainability of those biomass energy sources. So the whole system has to be taken into account. But your characterization of sort of where does the biomass energy piece fit in isn't exactly right.
And I don't know if you can answer this question, but okay, so natural gas from this biomass, methane, so it's like, do they take the waste and like grind it up and ferment it kind of like to get that methane out? Or like, do you know how that happens? I'm just curious.
I am not a chemist nor an engineer, so I couldn't give you a terribly good answer. The process is referred to as gasification.
Gasification, okay.
Yeah, and the input part of it, you're right. I mean, it involves when we're talking about forestry residues, it involves collecting sort of the waste biomass left behind in cut blocks, right? So like tree tops and branches and things that don't lend themselves to lumber and pulp mills and so on, and effectively grinding it up and putting it into then what for me is a bit of a black box as a non-chemist that actually gasifies the material. You'd have to ask a chemist to get into the details of how that exactly works.
Right. Well, there's hydrogen and carbon and all of that waste product that would just be a way to somehow turn it into methane, right? And I know bacteria release that. I'll maybe do some of my own research and talk about it in the podcast too. Well, okay, that's great. Climate change.
I was going to go a little further on the climate change piece because regardless of what we do to mitigate the degree to which we continue to change climate, the reality is that climate has changed and it is going to continue changing for some time. That changing climate is already impacting our forests. And so we talk in this space about the need to adapt to the realities of a changing climate. There was a remarkable study done by some folks associated with the Northern Forestry Center quite recently that, you know, using a bunch of computer models. And so you have to sort of, you know, recognize that there's a bunch of assumptions, things that go into that. But Diana Strahlberg and colleagues have estimated that over the next 80 years or so, up to half of the forest area in Alberta might be changed from its current state of sort of upland and mixed wood types of forests into a more deciduous and even grassland state as a result just of the changing climate, which has, profound implications for how we think about forest management and how we use our forests. And the other thing that is the sort of my third dimension of climate change as well is that some of these things have direct impacts on people's safety. So we do a lot of work related to forest fires as well. And fires, we're seeing more fires and more area burned every year. Western Canadians and Western Americans for sure have seen this in places like California and British Columbia and Alberta over the last, 5 years. Yeah. Over the last sort of 50 years or so, rounding off a little bit, you know, the area burned in Canada has pretty much doubled. And that trend is only going to continue. And so the sort of the third dimension that I was thinking about when I start off with my climate change three ways is that as the climate continues to change, our problem of forest fires is actually going to get worse. And that leads to some pretty significant changes that we need to make in terms of, you know, how we're managing forests around communities and around critical infrastructure, how we're designing and building neighborhoods and even homes when we get into what we refer to as the wildland urban interface. So effectively where, you know, places where people live work and play come into interface with the broader forested landscape. And another area of really significant challenge and an active area of research for us.
Yeah, I've read so many things about the whole forest fire issue. Climate change doesn't start a forest fire, but it increases the severity and the chances of it happening with drier conditions. And for everybody from Alberta, we remember like the Fort McMurray fire. That wasn't too long ago that happened. And with luck, that whole town didn't burn down, but parts of it were severely affected. But I've read some things that whole town could have been lost if not for luck. And that's what you're talking about with like the interface of these places where people live and they recreation, and how they're structured to protect them from forest fires. Am I on the right track there?
Absolutely. Yeah. As much as we would like to think that the Fort McMurray fire in 2016 was a one-off event, the reality is in the long run, it will not be a one-off event. What happened there really was a combination of weather, very hot, very dry, very windy conditions, with lots of fuel to burn, and a major city in the path of the fire. It's amazing, though, in 2016, and a lesson in sort of the, you know, how careful one has to be about using averages. The Fort McMurray fire at a national scale over the course of the fire season of 2016 in Canada was actually well below average in terms of the number of fires in the area burned. And yet, even in conditions that at that scale were not too bad. Of course, we had by far the most costly wildfire and the one of the most costly natural disasters in Canadian history.
I just one more question before we move on, just because you've touched on it. Do you get blowback when you say things from that like that from people who say, we've always had forest fires. What are you talking about? They're not going to get worse. I remember when I was a kid, there was forest fires. Like, do you get some blowback from that?
Less and less as people see and live through what has been happening, right? Like the reality is you can look around the world. This is not just a North American problem, right? Remember last year in Australia.
Australia was awful. Oh, my God, yeah.
And you can look, Portugal has had terrible fires, and Greece. And although we don't hear as much about them, huge fires in Russia. So the evidence is pretty clear and pretty much in people's news feeds for much of the year. And you know, when we talk about fire, there occasionally we do see some observers that doubt the kinds of statements that I'm making or challenge kind of the more specific scientific results that researchers at mine and other centers produce. In most cases, there's inappropriate interpretation or selective interpretation of the data. But one of the things that when we talk about climate adaptation, that one of the nice things that we can actually avoid is we actually can avoid debates. I'm not interested in the debate about whether or not climate is changing. Pointless. Its climate is changing, but we could stay out of the debates about how people think we should address sort of greenhouse gas emissions, which gets into very politically and economically and socially charged debate. When we're talking about just the reality of needing to adapt to a changing climate, there's much more tangible solutions that still have their controversy for sure, but also have really tangible benefit for people. Nobody wants to live in a home or in a community that is at high risk of being burned by the next major wildfire that comes along. And there are some very practical kinds of solutions that are catching on, particularly in the West, around a program called Fire Smart. for example, that provide advice and guidance from everything from your individual homeowner and how to maintain your property and your yard and your home to be more resilient to a fire when it occurs, up to things that we can do at a landscape level, including things like reducing the amount of forest fuel that can burn in a perimeter around a community so that if a fire does come along, there's greater opportunity for the fire suppression crews to stop the fire from getting into the community and so on. So it's a more productive space there that can stay out of some of the most difficult debates that are raging.
One more question. I was just thinking about it because your mind is always on this. Do you drive around Alberta, especially like in the forested communities, and you're like, ooh, like you just get the heebie-jeebies, like this could be a disaster? Do you see that? I'm oblivious to that until I talk to people like you.
To some degree, I try not to dwell on it too much. and actually, the space that I prefer to try to focus in is on the increasing number of examples that are out there that show action being taken to reduce those risks, right? Nice. So you can drive around, you can drive through the town of Edson, Alberta, you can drive through Whitecourt, Alberta, and others, just to name a couple of examples of communities that have, at a community scale, taken on FireSmart. Fort McMurray is doing some really good things as they recover from the fire a couple of years ago. There's a great example just in the last couple of years from the town of Jasper. So Jasper National Park, beautiful landscape, internationally renowned, and rightly so, one of my favorite places in the world. And as people from this area know, the mountain pine beetle has come through the park, has caused widespread death of the pine forests there. And pine forests, shortly after they've been killed by pine beetle, are rather prone to fire. And so the park, Jasper National Park, and the town of Jasper recognized this, a remarkable example of collaboration recently, in a way that's really counterintuitive, but the park actually contracted with a commercial forest company to do some harvesting of forests around the town of Jasper that delivered both economic value to the company, as well as a substantial reduction in fire risk to the town of Jasper. That happened right in the middle of a national park, that we had these relatively large scale forest harvesting operations in a way that people, that the residents of the park and visitors to the park, kind of understood why it was there, and has really reduce the provide a buffer really around the town of Jasper for the time, which frankly it's difficult to predict, but is inevitable at some point that there will be a fire in that valley.
Are those the signs you see, like this area is being, like, just to tell the public, right? I believe there's signs about it.
Yeah, I think there are. I mean, there had always been a sort of a smaller fire break around the town, just up behind the town, up onto the benches there. But for those that may not have visited recently, if you drive up behind the town now, the it's a much more open landscape than it used to be before. And I do believe that the park is intending to have some public interpretation to kind of explain what's going on and how it was done and why it was done and what the benefits are.
Yeah, smart, because otherwise you're going to be people upset. They're like, well, why are you cutting down all the trees? Well, so the town doesn't burn down. That's why, guys. So
there's an old saying that I absolutely love. It's that forest management is not rocket science. It's way more complicated. And and in a case like this, it just shows how many different dimensions have to go into the planning and decision making about some of the choices we make about our forests.
Wow, crazy. All right, well, my last question before we kind of get to the standard questions we ask our guests is, Is there an area of research that your facility's working on that you would be able to tell everybody about that's kind of interesting?
Yeah, so I've talked about a few of them as we've gone along here as well. I'll talk about another area that I think is growing in importance, or at least the recognition of its importance is growing. And we're not doing, at the Northern Forestry Center, we're not doing a lot of work in this space right now, although I'd love to find a way to get into it. And it's the whole area of urban forests.
Okay.
Which is may appear a bit like an oxymoron at first if you haven't encountered the concept before about how do you have a forest in an urban area. But our cities, all cities, have a tremendous amount of tree cover, almost forest cover. Some of that in kind of manicured urban parks. Others, like in the city of Edmonton, for example, we have an extensive natural forested area that runs along the North Saskatchewan River through the middle of the city.
That's the river valley, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so the downtown of Edmonton and the south part of Edmonton are separated by the river. So there's this gorgeous valley that you have to go across a bridge to get to downtown Edmonton if you're going north. Anyway, sorry.
No, that's all good. It's the North Saskatchewan River. Its headwaters are in the Rocky Mountains. And eventually, if you follow it all the way downstream, it ends up in Hudson Bay. So part of a major river system, very deep, quite wide valley, very heavily forested, right through the middle of the city. In the city of Edmonton, 10% of the city is covered by trees. Hmm. And that's actually, as it turns out, on the low end of average. The city of Toronto, Canada's largest city, has a forest cover of 20% of the city. And the value associated with these urban forests is high. So again, I just sort of looked up a couple of quick stats for Edmonton. The estimate as of about a decade ago, it probably hasn't changed that much, somewhere in the range of 13 million trees within the city limits, that the city estimated has a current value of somewhere around $1.2 billion. Not just because of what it would cost to replace the trees, but because of the benefits that we get from those trees. So trees in the city have air quality benefits. They actually measurably reduce air pollution in urban areas. If they're placed in appropriate areas around buildings, they can lead to 25% savings in the energy costs associated with buildings. They help manage, you know, water runoff and water quality. They even have a direct association with people's property values. You know, properties in more heavily treed areas on average are worth more. And we're starting to recognize, and I think this has been super important over the last years, everybody's been tied so close to home with the pandemic, that urban forested areas have measurable benefits for people's health, including their mental health, because of the green spaces that they provide. And of course, this is in the context of Canada, like most countries, like 80% of Canadians live in urban areas. So the forests that are right close to where we live are incredibly important. And I raise all this to say that, you know, of course, climate change is affecting our urban forests with things like water stress, drought, new kinds of pests that are coming in that are really challenging those forests. So sort of describing more an area that of research that is starting to pick up. The University of British Columbia, for example, has started programs in urban forestry, recognizing the importance of having highly qualified experts in this space to learn more about the benefits that we get from our urban forests and how to sustain them and maximize those benefits as cities continue to grow and climate continues to change.
That is so smart. You know, having these trained people run the urban forests if you could just make the argument, yeah, okay, so we don't have people manage our trees. The next time there's a heavy rainfall, get ready for massive damage due to flooding because the trees aren't scooping up all the extra water. I'm oversimplifying it, but I think that's the importance of having all of these trees just from one aspect.
That, yeah, no, exactly right. Another factoid here. So the TD Bank, one of the major national banks in Canada, has done a bit of a study on this in four of our major urban areas across the country, Toronto, Montreal, Halifax, and Vancouver. They put an estimated value just in those four cities of the urban forests of $51 billion. And really interestingly, that a very high range here, but they estimated that we are already getting more benefits out of those urban forests than is costing to manage and maintain them, with a low estimate of sort of somewhere around $1.50 in value returned for every dollar that goes into managing the forest. But up to almost $13.
Wow.
To one. So again, there's a lot to learn in this space, but there some of what we do currently know really points out the value of an aspect of our cities that we have often not really paid that much attention to.
That is insane. They make money.
They do.
Just be okay. There we go. I'm going to tell my students about that. I feel this is an area that's just going to explode as we learn more about it too, is like for people who are trained scientists to go into. That's so cool.
I love it.
Let's switch gears a bit. We always ask our guests a couple kind of like fun standard questions, and I'm curious for your stories and your take. The first one is for a pet story. We always ask our guests to share a pet story. Do you have one you could share with us, Mike?
Yeah, for sure. So at the moment, my family has two cats, two orange male cats we've had for a few years, deeply part of the family. Now, the funny story is actually how we got these gentlemen in the first place. Basically, I was out of town, and when I came back, there were cats in the house. So a few years ago, I'd actually just started working for the Canadian Forest Service, and I was at a national management meeting at our Atlantic Forestry Center in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and a group of us were out for dinner one night, and the old text machine started to ring a few times, and it was my wife starting to send me pictures of these cats that she and my daughters had found, and oh, aren't they absolutely adorable? And I said, yes, sure. lo and behold, by the time I got back from that business trip, we had acquired a couple of cats in the house. And although, I'll tell you, I am not a cat person, but I sort of have to nudge, wink, wink a little bit around that. I have one other quick pet story, actually, and it's just connecting to a recent piece of news that very sadly last week Canada lost one of its most outstanding, most highly regarded ecologists, Dr. David Schindler from the University of Alberta, passed away at the age of 80 last week. He was part of my graduate education at the U of A, and although I was not working in aquatic ecology, which was his specialty, he co-taught a couple of graduate courses, and in various ways had a pretty strong influence on me as a remarkable individual. And my other brief pet story is that I actually had adopted one of Dave's dogs. Dave used to run sled dogs, and he had a big group of Alaskan, like sort of mixed breed huskies that he used for sled dog racing. And he had one of the dogs had a litter that included a runt who was half the size of the siblings and was clearly never going to be suitable for dogs. So we adopted that dog. Her name was Kaylee, and we had her for about 10 years or so. And so with Dave's passing last week, I was remembering our former dog Kaylee as well, and all the good times we had with her and our connection back to Dave Schindler.
Aw, that's a great story, and a great story about a remarkable Canadian too. For people listening, not from Canada,
yeah, yes,
yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. That's a great story. Did you mention your cat's names? I forget. I'm sorry.
I did not. So the one cat's name is officially Morrison. We named him at the time after Van Morrison.
Yeah, Van Morrison.
Yeah, he generally goes by Mo, and he is our adorable village idiot. He's absolute sweetheart, but not the sharpest knife in the drawer. The other cat's full name is Buckaroo. He's just Buck all the time, occasionally known as Your Highness. He is the cat who, you know, looks like he would be very much at home sitting on a throne ruling his domain. So Mo and Buck.
It's funny how cats are either kind of the goofy or like the they want to rule.
Yes, exactly right. We have one of each.
So Mike, I think you've given away all your super facts. We normally ask for a super fact. I think people will understand how many crazy super facts you've already shared with us. So we'll move on past the super fact area to the last section of the podcast, and that's the important to you, your passion section, where guests get to share something they're really passionate about. And you wanted to touch on two things. One was a professional point, and that's on diversity, and the other is about photography, more personal passion. What did you want to touch on about diversity in industry?
Thanks. So, yeah, the whole issue of diversity and inclusivity is on all of our minds, and rightly so. Over the last number of years, you know, I'm a middle-aged white guy with a solidly upper middle class upbringing, and I'm increasingly aware of the privilege that I have had and continue to have. So there's a couple of areas in particular, though, that are incredibly important to me in this space, and not to diminish others that I won't talk about, but just a couple in particular. Women in science is a broad topic, and there's increasing recognition of the degree to which the STEM discipline, science, technology, engineering, and math have been heavily male dominated for a very long time, and tremendous work happening to support and encourage more women in those spaces. And forestry is, not surprisingly, no exception. So the whole industry of forestry, as well as the forest science domain that we're involved with at my center. Not that long ago, there was a lady who has now retired, but she remembers when she was hired into her job, she was the first and only woman in the center that wasn't in an administrative kind of role. So this is very recent history. And when I joined the Northern Forestry Center, it's still a very male-dominated place. And one of the things that I am grateful to see happening with the sustained efforts by everybody at the center is, you know, in the last 5 years or so, as we recruit new people into the center, is the way in which the gender balance is shifting significantly to where it really needs to be. We've hired some just wonderfully talented women into research scientists and technology specialists and other roles at the center, and continuing to ensure that we have a diverse workforce, including women in the science disciplines, is important. The other area is around reconciliation with Indigenous people, and like many countries, Canada has a, if I was being charitable, I would say that we have had a difficult relationship with Indigenous people, in the sense that we have done horrible things over time to Indigenous people in this country, through colonial structures, colonial attitudes, and really egregious offenses like the residential school system. And when we talk about in the specific context of forests, I think there is a real role for a 70, something like 70% of Indigenous people in Canada live in or near forests and have deep cultural relationships with forests. And there's a real opportunity for us at the Northern Forestry Centre and across the rest of the organization to really work to engage with and build meaningful, respectful relationships with Indigenous people, to learn from traditional knowledge about forests, and at the center we have we are very fortunate that we have an Indigenous elder who works with us as an elder in residence, from whom we are learning a huge amount of new perspective on things that most of us were ignorant of for far too long. We've developed a reconciliation strategy to ensure that that the spirit of reconciliation and tangible measures to work towards reconciliation with Indigenous people becomes part of the fabric, the very way we do science and research at our center. And we've even developed an Indigenous learning center that's a really wonderful learning space that was named and blessed through traditional ceremony and so on, that I really look forward to getting back to being able to use once we can return to our regular workplace more fully. We had an official opening for that Indigenous learning center just weeks before the pandemic sent us all to working from home. So that Indigenous reconciliation is another piece that we've got a long way to go. I think we're making some progress, but just profoundly important to me personally, and something that I look forward to continuing to try to lead on as long as I'm with this organization.
That's great. Yeah, what a profound statement on both. I've spoken about residential schools on the podcast before, and how it relates to science, and that's great that the organizations of our government and of other places are thinking about that as well. And that's great. You're getting, you know, more gender parity. I'll tell you, I was looking at the gender split in my chem classes, and it was like 70% girls and 30% guys. So, just making it welcome for everybody gets us towards parity.
Yeah, for sure. It does. It's been really interesting. And again, this is sort of just a microcosm of larger learnings about the extent to which women, and particularly women who are mothers, have been disproportionately challenged by the pandemic, because women are so often the primary caregivers in their families, and the pressure to, you know, hold down full-time careers while also, you know, delivering school from home for a period of time, and these kinds of things is also something that all workplaces need to really find new ways of equaling the playing field to ensure that women are fully supported through all phases of their careers, right from education through entry into the workplace and support right through the full career.
Mm. Good point. Yeah. You wanted to touch on photography. What's going on there, Mike?
So I've been a hack photographer for, a number of years, and had, never really gotten super serious about it. But, where the pandemic hit and some people became expert makers of sourdough bread and expert quilters and things like that, my passion, particularly over the last year, has been far more time behind the camera than I've ever been able to spend before, including in some cases, literally in my backyard, and if not literally, then at least metaphorically in my backyard, in and around the city of Edmonton, out at Elk Island National Park, which is just outside the city. And it's one of those sort of hidden blessings of a year's worth of life that requires us to stick much closer to home and to stay away from other people, that and you talk about focusing in on the positives. My photography skills are still very amateur in the grand scheme, but it's been a real pleasure to be able to develop some of those talents over the last year, whether it's, you know, taking ultra close-up photographs of, you know, dragonflies and tomatoes and petunias in my backyard, landscape shots, even trying some urban photography and getting out and walking around the central part of the city to learn to appreciate it in a new way through the lens. I don't think, if it hadn't been for the pandemic, I don't think I would have ever invested that kind of time. So and ending on a positive note, it's been a tough year, but there is a silver lining if you look for it. And in my case, it's been the extent to which I've been able to, like I said, spend time with the camera and seeing my talents, I hope, improving. Certainly my sense of satisfaction in what I'm producing is increasing.
I'll tell you, my photography skills definitely improved once Bunsen got to be famous on the internet.
No doubt. Because
I was just random, you know, you just randomly take some pictures and you don't think about it. And then when you know, for us, eyeballs are going to be on every picture of the dogs, right? I learned where to shoot, where the light, what time of the day works best. Like, yeah. If you take a picture at like 8 o'clock p.m. inside your house with artificial light, it looks like garbage. But if you take the same picture with natural light, it's a big difference.
Yeah.
Photography's pretty fun. I'd imagine taking a picture of a dragonfly is probably about as easy as taking a picture of a moving golden retriever puppy. So it depends on what you're.
Yeah. If you just get yourself all set and he takes off and you have to.
Exactly.
Yeah. Track him down and try over again. But yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Beaker stay. Yeah. Oh, right. You're a puppy. You don't do that yet.
Exactly.
All right. Well, this has been such a fun and informative chat. Thanks for agreeing to talk to us, Mike, about all things forests and some kind of deep issues there at the end. And ending on a positive is always a positive pause. There's the pun. The pun comes.
Yeah. That's why you're the host.
That's right. Can people follow you or the Forestry Center online? Like, are there some media accounts there?
So I personally am on Twitter at Northern_Norton. There are a number of other folks at the center that have personal Twitter accounts that they use in a professional way. We are part of the Federal Department of Natural Resources Canada, who of course have an official Twitter account as well. And actually, if I could make a plug to two sources of information that folks may wish to go and look up to for deeper dives on some of these topics. The first is a product called the State of Canada's Forests. Dull sounding title. The report, though, is an annual thing that that the Canadian Forest Service puts out. It's far more interesting than that title would suggest. It's filled with the most robust set of facts about our forests and our forest industry, interspersed with articles about some of the science that we do. That report is easy to Google, State of Canada's Forests, freely available online. And the other thing close to home in Alberta, the Alberta Forest Products Association, an industry association, recently put out an interactive online interpretive tool about forests in Alberta, hosted by Nathan Fillion, the actor.
Nathan Fillion.
That Nathan Fillion is the voice of this. It's an absolutely fantastic resource, really entertaining, again, full of facts that you can explore your way around forests in Alberta, from young forests up to old forests. Also freely available, easy to Google online as a way for folks to dig in and explore some of these topics themselves.
You had me at Nathan Fillion.
You're right.
Yeah. So for people who are like, who is this guy? Well, he was on a couple huge TV shows, Castle, and I think he's on The Rookie now. And he's from Edmonton, right? He's an Edmonton guy.
He is from Edmonton.
Yeah, yeah. And for the people that listen, know that I'm a giant nerd and I cosplay Captain Malcolm Reynolds. Nathan Fillion's first famous character from Firefly was the first character I cosplayed as. So there you go. That's the connection.
There we go. Full circle.
There you go. Well, thanks for sharing your stories and your life stories and your knowledge with us today. I so appreciate it, Mike.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
It's time for Woo or Wow on the Science Podcast. And I have patron Liz Button back again. How's it going, Liz?
Going well. How are things with you?
Good. I just got my AstraZeneca shot today. So,
How you feeling?
I am doing good. I'm not even using Wi-Fi to talk to you. I'm just using the microchip they put in my body.
You, Bill Gates.
I don't even have to sink into anything. I can just think about it and then I can connect to the interweb. So this is great. I'm going to save so much money on rural high-speed internet. You have no idea.
Nice.
You had mentioned you're working on your dissertation. So how's that going?
I spent 5 hours today trying to find new journal articles because my chair told me, keep it concise. So I submitted a chapter. I was like, here you go. It's 12 pages. Like, yeah, we're looking for 25. Like, oh boy. So, just tons of researching and lots of reading only to produce a page. Research is fun.
I just have so much respect for the people that went past the bachelor's, because that's what killed me. That's what I didn't enjoy was the research in my science degree. I was better as a presenter. I was like the person they threw in front of the class to talk. I was that person, and the people who did all the work, were like, no, we don't want to get him to talk. He can talk. So that's probably why I'm a teacher and not a researcher.
But I bet you were popular amongst the shy kids.
I tried my best to help out, and they were like, but I just was more comfortable talking. I think it's because I was like a lifeguard, because when you're a lifeguard and swim instructor, all you do is shout and talk. So, and you mentioned every day is the same. You said it was kind of like Groundhog Day for you.
Yeah, Groundhog Day 300 and something.
Have you learned any new skills like Bill Murray?
Sadly, no.
No? Just working on your dissertation, though.
Yeah, and work and curriculum. And
one of these days it will be over, just like Bill Murray's repeating day and Groundhog Day. I can't imagine a worse kind of hell than being stuck in the same day working on your dissertation for eternity. So, there are worse things, I guess.
True.
All right. So you ready for Woo or Wow? You're 3 for 3, right?
Yes.
No pressure. No pressure.
None at all.
The topic this week is trees. How do you feel about trees?
I'm more of a fauna person than a flora person. I have trees outside, and it's we're in that weird kind of you guys seem to have the fake spring, where it was 76 today, and then looking at the weather, it's going to be 33 tomorrow night. So, all the trees are starting to bloom, and then we get to look forward to the cicadas next month.
Oh, man, that's right. You guys get cicadas. That's so cool. Mm-hmm.
Brood X every 17 years. We're in the hot spot.
Can't wait for the videos and the tweets, and then people will be like, love them. And then 2 days later, they'll be like, I hate them. They're so loud.
Yes.
Because I think 17 years ago, there wasn't social media to complain. So we'll see.
No. driving through everything and just smacking into your car. I was like, this is fine.
Oh, that's so neat. Yeah, we don't have that. I guess every year we just get annoying things like moose legs that the dogs get into. So anyways. All right. So for the people that are, this is maybe their first time listening. Woo Wow is kind of a trivia section. I read three statements. Two of them are fake. They're woo. And one of them is true. It's a wow. And the guest has to try and find the true statement. Okay, here we go. Statement one. Around 5% of the population of Earth uses wood as fuel to cook their meals.
5%?
5%. Yeah, around 5% of the population of Earth uses wood fuel to cook their meals. Now, there's nothing like, for me, food just tastes better when you cook it on a fire. But that's like a Canadian thing, so.
Charcoal.
Yeah. All right. Statement two. The oldest tree in the world is 500 years old and found on Vancouver Island as a redwood tree.
Okay, so 500, taking notes. Notes with your Bunsen pen and sticky pad.
Oh, awesome. Those Bunsen pens last a while. Mine's still kicking.
Yeah, they're awesome.
Okay.
People should go order them.
Thanks for the plug. Statement three. In the 19th century, the Americans purposely filled their parks with squirrels for entertainment purposes. They were rarely found outside of the forest beforehand.
Purposely messed with squirrels.
Yeah, you chucked them in your park so you could have something to do. Watch them. Feed them peanuts. That's what the statement is. I don't know if you're going to have to figure out if that's true or not, or if I just made that up.
Okay.
Do you want to recap, or are you good?
I think I know one of them that's not true. So, yeah, let's hear them again.
Okay. Statement one. try that again. Statement one. Around 5% of the population of Earth uses wood fuel to cook their meals. Statement two. The oldest tree in the world is 500 years old and found on Vancouver Island as a redwood. Statement three. In the 19th century, Americans purposely filled their parks with squirrels for entertainment purposes.
Let's see. I think the one about the oldest tree is a woo.
Okay.
Because you're saying it's only 500 years, and I vaguely remember from, you know, elementary school, wherever it was, that there are some trees that are thousands of years old. And I know we love to destroy anything, you know, outside down here in America. So hopefully we haven't cut all those down yet. So I'm vacillating between 5% of the world and then playing with squirrels for funsies. I know we have kind of an ethnocentric view, like, you know, we're first world, you know, countries, we cook on food for fun, we're going camping, but I think for a lot of other people in the world, it's more of a necessity. So I feel like it would probably be more than 5%. So I think that one is a woo. So just for fun, let's say there were no electronics back in the 18th century, so let's entertain ourselves with some squirrels.
Okay. All right. Final answer, Liz.
I hope so, because I really like to be right.
Let's take a look at statement two. You said that was a woo. You were pretty confident about that. You heard sometime, somewhere, trees are older than that. And you're correct. Okay. That statement was false. The oldest tree is actually found in California, based on the evidence, the oldest tree is found in California based on my research. It is around 5,000 years old, and it's called a bristlecone pine. Crazy.
It's not a redwood?
No, it's a bristlecone pine. That's what I was shocked it wasn't a redwood.
I don't even know what that is.
I don't know either, but it kind of makes sense because at least on Vancouver, I haven't been down through Washington. I know there's redwoods down on the West Coast there. In Canada, the root system of redwoods is very deep, so they blow over in wind.
Really?
So, yeah, because it's so wet. The roots need to go deep for water. That could be different for other redwoods. Don't fact check me on that, people. Okay, so that leaves two statements left. One is about cooking on fire, and the other is about squirrels. Which one do you want to hear first?
Let's go with the cooking with fire.
All right. So if this one turns out to be woo, you've won because you've said the squirrel one is a wow, right?
Yeah. Okay.
The statement 5% of the population of Earth uses wood fuel to cook their meals is a woo. You're 4 for 4, Lou.
Yes.
It is
higher.
What's
the actual percent? Okay.
It's way higher. And I had it verified by a couple different sources. It's like 1 in 3 people on planet Earth.
Really?
33% of people use wood to cook their meals. Yeah. Not natural gas, not heating elements through electricity, wood fuel. So that's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. And that means the last one is true.
I'm going to need to hear a little more about that one.
I don't know more than that. It's.
Come on.
Yeah, like I did. I checked into it, and it turned like it was verified by a couple sources, and I guess some early cities kind of all got on the same page, and they trapped squirrels and brought them in and chucked them out in their parks with enough random squirrels. They got some male and females randomly, and they propagated like crazy. Also, they were fed, right? So it was a really nice place for squirrels to live. It was easy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And it was for entertainment purposes. They thought they would get more people to come to their city and enjoy the parks, bring nature to the city. You could enjoy the city life, but also the country life and see the adorable squirrels and feed them, right?
So right, because squirrels get the acorns and they bury them and forget where they are, and then you get trees. I don't know. I've read it on the internet. It's got to be true.
I just know that that's one of the animals Bunsen does chase. Is he does not like squirrels. He will chase a squirrel. All right, 4 for 4, very impressive.
Yay! Thank you.
That's going to be hard to beat. I think there's only one other person that could potentially catch up to you, and that's a teacher at our school, Jackie Shukin.
Oh, all right. We should have like a final battle at the end. Like, who knows the most useless crab?
It was a pleasure again, Liz, and thank you so much for being a patron of Bunsen and Beaker content.
Oh, absolutely. It's my pleasure to support such awesome work. Can't wait to see what's coming up next.
Yeah. Oh, and I saw you got the postcard. The picture we picked for it was pretty adorable this time.
One of you is a really good photographer.
I think I'm getting better, right? It's just practice. That's all it is.
My anal pictures are just blurry. It's like, thanks, guys.
Yeah, well, that's why there's no really good pictures of Bunsen from like 0 to 10 months, because all of them were terrible. And I didn't know he was going to become famous, so I wasn't like taking pictures of him every day. Which is too bad, because he was so cute as a puppy. I would have had hundreds of adorable pictures. All right, well, take care of yourself, and I guess maybe you got to get back to your work on your dissertation. I know that's like not the most fun, but we're going to be all so thrilled and proud of you when it's all finished.
Thanks. Yeah, I got to finish grading because I got to submit midterm grades by midnight.
Oh, yeah. The never-ending, because you're a professor as well. There's marking that goes with that. Yep.
All right, see you later.
Okay, it's time for story time with me, Adam. So, story time. If you guys don't know what story time is, it's when we talk about stories that have happened within the past 1 or 2 weeks. I start sometimes. My story is about Beaker sleeping on me. So, if you don't know, Beaker's a little fuzzy thing. And when she's sleepy, she doesn't really care. So, if she's on the couch with you, you can kind of just grab her and manipulate her sponginess into laying on you. And she's like a cat like that, yeah. And sometimes she sleeps on you, and you can play video games and have the Beaker on you. Well, one of our patrons got a postcard, and the only words on it were, "Thanks, Adam, Adam, Bobadam." That one was a test card for like what I was writing. I wasn't the one who wrote the thanks notes, it was Mom. But I did one card that said thanks, and then I realized that it was stupid, and then I signed it because I thought, oh, I might as well sign it. And then Mom sent it out. I felt really bad about it.
Yeah, but the patron really liked it.
The patron really liked it. So, yeah.
It's on their fridge.
Yeah, it wasn't meant to go out, but it's on their fridge now.
So they have like a 1 in 2 edition.
Yeah, 1 in 2 edition. If you guys have a messed up card that I wrote on it, I only wrote on 2 cards. So tweet back to us or tweet at us to tell us about the card. Yeah, okay, Mom, do you have a story?
I sure do. I actually have an amazing story this week. Actually, it's not really amazing, but it is a story. So the dogs went to doggy daycare this week on Tuesday. And when there's anything different, if I'm putting on a coat or I'm moving in a different way or I have the keys in my hand, they perk up and think, am I coming? Am I coming? Am I coming? And their whole demeanor changes and they stick to me like Velcro because just in case they get to come. Well, Tuesday they got to come and they were so happy. But then I also took them in the car to pick up Adam from school, and Beaker was just so excited to see him on Tuesday after school. She was like, oh my God, it's Adam. And she was like crying and really wanting to jump out of the car at him. And then I've taken them to town twice actually since then, and they're still so excited. And I picked up Adam another day from school, and again, super excited. And today we dropped off his computer at lunchtime for him. But it's really nice to go out and about. I actually unrolled the window and, it's Adam's school, but Jason teaches there too. And the kids were like, oh, so I don't know if they realized it was the famous Bunsen that they saw, but they thought he was pretty cute. And he was like, oh, hello. But that's my story.
Well, the kids at the school know Bunsen. Dad sometimes takes him in and then lets kids pet him. Yeah, Dad, do you have a story?
So I'll apologize if I sound a little flat. I'm recovering from the vaccine. I'm so happy I got it. I got the AstraZeneca, but it definitely knocked me down a bit. About 12 hours after the shot, maybe 10 hours. I don't know. Anyways, I'm a little fuzzy.
5 hours.
5 hours?
You were like,
oh, I got so tired. I barely made it through teaching today. But a story about the dogs pre-getting the vaccine. We've had crazy weird weather. It's been gorgeous nice. Like today was so nice. And it's going to snow. I know it's going to snow. Like yeah. It's in the forecast to snow again.
Yeah.
And it snowed.
It's forecast for tomorrow.
Yeah, it's forecast to snow. And it snowed, I don't know, 5 days ago. And it was, the dogs had so much fun because it was great big fluffy white flakes, and they were just roaring around, and the flakes were kind of like pulling the branches down. So when they would blast through the scrubby brushes in the trees, they would go and explosions of like snowflakes would go everywhere. Anyways, it's kind of like the last hurrah of the winter. But yeah, we've had weird weather. It was so hot today, and then like it's just taken a turn. It's going to snow. So Bunsen will be happy about that. I think Chris is all done with this kind of nonsense.
I'm all done with the nonsense.
Okay, that's my story.
Beaker's being very cute. Okay, that's my section of the podcast. That's family section. Thank you guys for listening, and I hope to see you guys next time. Bye-bye.
That's the end of another podcast episode. Thanks so much for tuning in every week for Science, Empathy, and Cuteness. Also, special thanks to Michael Norton, who talked to us about all things forest and climate change and probably some things that the average person doesn't think about if they don't live in Alberta. Thanks, dogs. And we also like to give our patrons a shout out at the end of the podcast. Their support makes running this possible. If you want to hear your name at the end of the podcast, head to patreon.com/BunsenBurner. Take it away, Chris.
Nate Stephenson. Debbie Anderson, Courtney Proven, Renee Hardy, Mary Rader, Shelby Leggett, Daniel Fry, Mary Coos, Katia Lynch, Marianne McNally, Andrea Persons, Elizabeth Bourgeois, Karen Beth St. George, Bianca Hyde, Catherine Jordan, Donna Craig, Lila Ashir, Jody Ogren, Liz Button, Kathy Zerker, and Ben Rathert.
Let's close with the dog's motto. For science, empathy, and cuteness.